We have mixed feelings about China in the United States. It's one thing to turn over just about any product in a room and see made in China on the underside. It's another to run up a huge national debt and have it derided in political campaigns as the money we owe to China. And for older Americans, there's the additional disconnect of seeing the closed-off communist China of years ago compared to the economic as in capitalist powerhouse of today. Our guest monitors the rise of China in his book, The Contest of the Century, The New Era of Competition with China and How America Can Win. Jeff Dyer is the author. He's an award-winning journalist for the Financial Times, formerly the paper's Beijing bureau chief. His education includes time at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Jeff, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
You begin by describing what appears to be a very well-manicured 60th birthday party for the China Revolution. What was the overall feeling you were left with on that day in Beijing?
So this was back in 2009, October the 1st, and this was the 60th anniversary of the People's Republic of China. And it was really, I mean, for me, it was this moment where you suddenly get the sense of this very proud country that was really kind of starting to change the way it thought about its role in the world. After Mao Zedong died and Deng Xiaoping launched a series of economic reforms in the late 70s, China really kind of kept its head down internationally. It just concentrated on growing its economy, developing society, and developing its power internally. But this is one of those moments where you start to realize that actually China has reached a stage where it wants to start influencing the world around it and shaping the world around it. It wants to act like an important great power that it now is. And it was just a sense that the emotional temperature in the country had really started to change in a profound way.
But yeah, I just have to wonder, I guess not just for China, but I suppose this would be true of any country. Once you've got this economic power that China clearly has in the world, what else do you want that you haven't got? I mean, what other kinds of power do you want when you've already got the world buying so many of your products and enriching you?
There should be absolutely nothing surprising the fact that China is thinking about itself in this way. There's actually a very interesting Henry Kissinger quote I use in the book. He's actually talking about the U.S. in the 1890s. And he said that no nation has ever experienced such an increase in its power without seeking to translate it into global influence. That's the kind of moment that China has now reached, where it has accumulated all this sort of economic power, and it wants to start using that to try and shape the world around it. Because it also, it has this huge economy, but that means it has all these very important interests around the world that it now needs to start defending. It can no longer just sit back and keep its head down and concentrate on its own domestic economy. If it wants to keep China at home humming along, it needs to get much more engaged in the rest of the world. And just one way to think about that is to say, the things that China needs to keep its economy going, it relies on iron ore from Brazil, copper from the Congo, coal from Indonesia, oil from Sudan. So it's hugely exposed to all these very different events around the world. And so it just can no longer be passive anymore. It needs to come out and start behaving in the way that big, powerful, important countries do behave.
All right. So as we begin to talk about things like when the Americans are always talking about we have to protect American interests in country X, whatever that is, China is very much the same boat then.
It's starting to go along this road. I mean, this is not something that's happening overnight, but it's just part of a long-term but very powerful, important historical process where China is going to find itself in that same kind of position, because it's going to have the same kind of scale as the U.S. It's going to find itself with all these different interests around the world. As you say, the U.S. is found with oil in the Middle East, and China is very exposed to oil in the Middle East, very exposed to oil in Africa, very exposed to resources in Latin America. And so, as you say, it can no longer sit back. It has to go out and try and influence these events and make sure that they don't evolve in ways that will damage China.
Jeff Dyer, you set out three main points early in the contest of the century. Number one, China wants to shape the world, not just participate in it. Number two, there is geopolitical competition with the United States. Number three, the United States is in a strong position to deflect this rise on the growing of Chinese power. I want to come back to point one, though. China wants to shape the world. You write in the book that it is impossible to detach ideology from the way China relates to the rest of the world. What does that mean?
Well clearly, part of the way that the Chinese Communist Party thinks about the world is trying to keep itself, the world, safe for the Chinese Communist Party. So you can never completely take away ideology from it. Part of what they're trying to do is to make sure that there's no coherent intellectual challenge to the Communist Party, that foreign countries cannot pressure the Communist Party to give up power. So that's always part of what they're doing. But I think it's a mistake to say this is too much about ideology, and this is one way in which it's very different from the Cold War. A lot of the ways that China's thinking about itself are really rooted in its history, are rooted in its geography. And if China was a sort of liberal democracy, became a liberal democracy tomorrow, a lot of the things that it's doing in terms of building up its navy, the way it's thinking about its economic interests and the way it's starting to push back a bit against the U.S., those would still be very much in place. They, you know, so it's not just the fact that this is a one-party dictatorship that's driving all this. It's much more deeply rooted in Chinese history and Chinese geography.
But isn't Chinese history is somewhat insular for many centuries, isn't it, in the sense that China tended to keep to itself and not want a lot of outsiders in?
Well, China's never been, it's never had been a global power. It was always much more interested in Asia. But if you're one of the countries around Asia, around China on its borders, you would definitely not say that it's been a very insular country. I mean, just to give you one example, I mean, the Qing Dynasty China, that was the China that ruled from the 1600s to the 1900s, was almost twice the size of Ming Dynasty China from the 1300s to the 1600s. So the Chinese history through that period and through many other periods has been one of constantly expanding borders of frontiers that have been constantly moving, a whole series of different conflicts and contests and competitions involved in that with China and its neighbors. So although it's never really had global ambitions, it's been a very much a moving feast in Asia, and most of its other countries around it have long memories of various ways in which China, when China was imperial power in the region, was a much more expansionist kind of country.
A regional power now seeking to become a world power. We're talking about China and the contest of the century, Jeff Dyer's book about the rise of China and the American response to it. You can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange when we come back from this break. Jeff Dyer and you in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Jeff Dyer, an award-winning journalist for the Financial Times, formerly its Beijing bureau chief. He has written a book about China, The Contest of the Century, The New Era of Competition with China, and How America Can Win. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about China's rise and the American response to it. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. Jeff, you alluded to this already about a history lesson from American history that really sort of bears some further examination in the context of China today. American foreign policy post-Civil War and China foreign policy now. And it was an interesting look at how things got kind of stuck between the White House and Congress for a couple of decades after the Civil War. But once they got in gear, that's when America really sort of zoomed to the front of countries.
Yes, very much so. I mean, after the Civil War, there was a huge sort of, you know, contest, if you like, between the executive and legislative branches. It was really only in the 1890s when the executive started to exert a bit more control. And at the same time, the American Navy started to expand to a certain critical mass that America was able to translate the size of its economy, which was already huge at that time, into much more global influence. And there's, you know, there are parallels with China at the moment. I mean, China has spent the last 20 years investing very heavily in its Navy. And it's really only in the last few years that it started to have the kind of critical mass, the kind of assets that it can start thinking about trying to shape events in Asia. It can start to, you know, influence the decisions that some of its neighbors are going to make and in some sense push them around. So that's, you know, it's one parallel. But the way that the parallel with the U.S. doesn't fit is that it's almost the opposite has happened in Chinese politics. One of the reasons why China has become more ambitious and aggressive in the last few years is actually you've had a lot of fracturing of power within the system. So that the senior leaders in China are no longer as important and powerful as they once were. They were able to actually restrain a lot of the tensions within Chinese society that would want it to be more ambitious and be able to damp down some of that pressure and to damp down the military as well. But what you've seen in the last few years, you've seen sort of popular nationalism has grown much more stronger. That's pushing the government to take a more aggressive stance. You've seen the military start to have a more influential role. You have big state-owned companies that are going and doing deals around the world and pulling the government into all sorts of arrangements that might not be so comfortable with. So the whole series of ways in which, because power has become more dispersed within the system in China, the top leaders are finding themselves pulled into all these international issues that they might not have otherwise wanted to get involved in.
Did the dispersal of power come about because of policies of some of the previous leaders? I mean, some of this obviously would be a reaction to Mao Zedong and the fact that he did consolidate so much power, and it was a pretty strange country, at least on the world's eyes for a long time. But was the dispersal of power by design or simply because there are so many competing interests within China's top hierarchy?
So it's really all of these things. I mean, it's partly just the fact of the different people involved. I mean, Deng Xiaoping was, you know, was a sort of revolutionary hero and therefore and a military hero as well, and therefore had a huge amount of credibility within the system that his successors have not had. Partly it's by design that after the disasters of the Mao era, China deliberately has set up the system so that you cannot have one big, powerful strongman in the Mao mold, and so that the leaders change power every 10 years. There's now there's a committee called the Standing Committee that's much more powerful now in terms of where the Communist Party is run than it was under Mao. So it's almost a dictatorship by committee than a one dictatorship. But then also what you've had is the growth of these different vested interests within the party. So you have these huge state-owned companies now. They're some of the biggest companies in the world. They're very powerful actors within the system. You have very important local governments now that didn't really exist, obviously, 20 years ago, but they weren't quite so rich or powerful as they are now. And you have the military as well that's received all this money and attention for the last 20, 30 years. And then now thinks, well, we've got all these assets. Maybe we should start to use them in some way. So you have all these different pressures that have built up from below. And then finally, you have the growth of this, very large, ambitious, urban middle class, very well educated. And those are people who think that, this is China's time. This is our time to sort of make our impression on the world. And so that's too sort of influencing the way, reducing the space that the senior leaders have to do their own thing. So they're finding themselves pushed in all sorts of ways that they're not familiar with.
The desire to take a bigger role on the world stage, though, I mean, you're pretty explicit about saying this really does not look like what European powers did, say, pre-19th century. How is it different?
One of the big differences is that China is much more locked into the global economy than any of those powers were. I mean, Germany before the First World War and then Germany and Japan before the Second World War, they had these very serious reservations that they were being cut out of the system by the colonial powers, that they were not given access to the kinds of raw materials that they wanted to have to boost their economies. And so that gave them this added incentive to be more aggressive in pushing their claims. One of the big differences is that China is much more locked into the global economy. It's the U.S. has essentially given it access to all this stuff. It's allowed it to go out and do these deals around the world to get access to its raw materials. So it doesn't quite have the same sort of underlying sense of being wronged that those other powers have. Now, that doesn't necessarily translate in the way sometimes the way that Chinese think about the U.S. and discuss the U.S., but underlying it means there's a little bit less tension. The globalization process over the last 20 years is much, much deeper in that sense than it was before the First World War.
When you talk about the United States allowing China to make some of these deals, I mean, what were the levers that the United States had, and did it not use them simply because there was an opportunity to be made money in the United States?
That's part of it as well. But there are these very powerful links between the U.S. economy and the Chinese economy as well. Chinese investments in American Treasury bonds, all the goods that the U.S. imports from China, both of which are the breaks, if you like, on aggressive behavior by either country, in a sense. They're a restraining force that means that while you do have this growing competition and growing clash of interests between the two countries, you do have this big, powerful economic restraints as well that are holding them back. So there's these two dueling forces, if you like, that are going to govern the way they behave in the coming decades.
Well, so that brings up an important point, though, that there are limits to how far China would want to take anything because they do depend on the United States and much of the West for buying their products. So you can't be too mean to the people who are buying your stuff, right?
You can't, although we can't be, as history tells us, we can't be too optimistic about this as well. I mean, this is the 100th anniversary of the start of the First World War, and 1913, 1914, lots of people in Europe at the time said that there'll never be a war in Europe because of all the economic links between the different countries. And as it happens, Germany and the UK had powerful trading links at that time, not as powerful as the US and China have now, but still quite important links, but cultural links as well. So these things are a break on China. They are a break on a more expansionist, aggressive Chinese policy, but we can't sort of be too fatalistic about it. We can't assume that those kind of economic links will stop countries from behaving in the way that great powers have behaved in the past.
Jeff Dyer is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a journalist working for the Financial Times, rather. His book is The Contest of the Century, The New Era of Competition with China. and how America can win. Share your thoughts about the rise of China and any concerns or questions you have about it with Jeff. Our phone number is here, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. When we talk about this as a contest between the United States and China, this is not entirely a vacuum. I mean, there are other countries in the mix. Are they just not nearly as powerful or potentially influential as these two?
No, they're very much in the mix, and that's one thing that's very much in America's favor. It's one of the reasons why it's actually quite hard for China to push back against the U.S. And so, specifically in Asia, I mean, if this was in Asia, if this was just about China trying to push out the U.S., then the U.S. would be in a very weak position because it's 8,000 miles away. But the big advantage that the U.S. has is that really, if you go around the region, there's a whole series of countries that very much want the same things. It's not just traditional as the U.S. It's not just the U.S.'s traditional allies of Japan and South Korea, but it's also Australia, Indonesia, the Philippines. Even a country like Vietnam is very keen to keep the U.S. involved in the region as a buffer against a more aggressive, powerful China. So the U.S. has this very favorable position where it has all these other countries that are potential partners and allies over the next few decades that it can join forces with to try and shape events and try and remain relevant. So the balance of power is very much in the U.S. favor in that sense.
You do point out that the United States should probably avoid isolation or confrontation. Is that a little bit of a trick, though, given that the United States, particularly in foreign policy, tends to be kind of black and white in its thinking?
Well, I'm not so sure the U.S. like that. I mean, clearly there is there's a lot of sentiment in the U.S. at the moment that we've become overexposed, that we did too much in the last decade in Iraq and Afghanistan. But I'm not one of the people that would define that as isolationism. I just think that's a sort of natural rebalancing from having tried to do too much in the Bush years. It's a sort of norm. It's a return to more normal equilibrium. The U.S. is still absolutely engaged around the world and very much present around the world, especially in Asia, but the Middle East and in Europe. So I don't see a very strong isolation sentiment at the moment. But certainly, you know, if the economy doesn't really pick up, if you have, you know, another decade where middle-class salaries stagnate, it's entirely possible to imagine that the U.S. would turn a bit more in on itself. That's, you know, a genuine real risk that we'd have to watch out for.
Well, that would, but that kind of works with the idea that if China continues to rise and we don't, that it may be because they are rising that we are falling. Is that a common conception, and is it a misconception?
There's definitely a common conception. I don't necessarily see it that way. One way to think about that is to say the perception in this country is that, you know, China has done incredibly well in the last decade by taking all these manufacturing jobs that were in the U.S. But actually, when you look at what's happened in China in the last decade, you know, wages have gone up a lot in China. It's gone up 10% a year for the last decade. So China is no longer the sort of cheap place to do manufacturing anymore. In fact, China is losing a lot of these kind of jobs to other countries around it. So it's not a sort of zero-sum game where every job that's added in the Chinese economy, it's a job that's taken away from the U.S. economy. So both of those countries are in a constant struggle to try and stay relevant, to try and stay ahead of the game, to try and have things to offer in the global economy. And neither, it's not a case where one is taking away from the other. It's a constant story of adaptation to keep up.
Jeff Dyer, you picked some surprising examples in the contest of the century of China's changes. How does Miss World figure in all of this?
So one of the great examples, actually, of just what I'm trying to say, is this place in Hainan Island on the south coast of China. And there's this beach there, a man-made beach called Yalong Bay. And one half of the beach, you have these series of international luxury hotels. There's a Ritz-Carlton, there's a Holiday Inn, there's a Marriott. It's very, very sort of high-class international tourism where lots of Chinese go, but lots of foreigners go, and lots of Russians go there. And actually, for five times in the last decade, they've held the Miss World competition there. And so it's kind of an example of a sort of globalized China, this kind of cosmopolitan, internationalized side of China. But these hotels are really only on the one side of the beach. On the other side of the beach, you have China's most modern naval base, although they have all sorts of frigates and destroyers. And then there's also this this very sophisticated submarine base that you can't actually see, but the satellite photos have shown there are these deep tunnels in the rocks that the submarines enter into, in and out of. I mean, it's a pure kind of James Bond type of scene. And so this is the kind of the contrast you have. You have this globalization China, one part of the beach, and then great part of China. On the other part of the beach, this navy that's looking to actually control the seas around it and influence and dominate some of its neighbors. So these two forces just together on this one place, on this beach in southern China.
Was China really slow to come around to the idea of beefing up its navy? Because, as you point out, I mean, there's this view in the region that that the U.S. has viewed the Pacific Ocean as its lake since World War II.
Yes, I mean, it's really only the last 20 years. I mean, even in the Mao period, China basically had a kind of coast guard, and it was actually nothing more than that. And it was barely aware that the U.S. Navy was just sort of out there patrolling the seas around it. But it's been a decisive move over the last two decades to put a lot of resources into the Navy. I mean, the military as a whole has expanded a lot. Defense spending has gone up by more than 10% every year for the last 20 years. But within that, the Navy has been given the pride of place. And it's part of this sort of much deeper strategy of thinking that Chinese think that for various reasons they need to start controlling the seas around it, the East China Sea towards South Korea and Japan, and the South China Sea down towards the Philippines and Vietnam. And that's a place both for them to start influencing events around them, but also to guarantee their security, to prevent another country from, if you like, cutting them off from the global economy. And so after 20 years, you start to have, when you spend that kind of money on your armed forces, you start to have a very powerful, important military. And China's now got to the stage where it has that kind of critical mass that can start thinking about trying to influence events around it.
Is there any sort of a guns versus butter trade-off here? Because it seems like China's consumer economy is growing so rapidly that it is probably able to sustain as well this buildup in the military at the same time. They're not bankrupting themselves, in other words.
Not yet, but it's a very good point, actually. I mean, in the last 20 years, the economy has grown so quickly that they've been able to increase spending on the military without it sort of taking away from other things. But now the Chinese economy is slowing now, and it grew at sort of double-digit rates in the previous decade. It's now looking at 7% growth, but they still have the same kind of growth in the military. So this year it's going to go up by sort of 12, 13%. So if the economy does keep slowing to that rate, then it is going to be a case where they are going to be having to take money away from other bits of the government in order to finance the military. But yeah, even then, it's much easier to do that in an economy that's growing at 7% than an economy that's growing at 1 or 2% like the U.S. The sort of budget fights are intense, but not quite so intense. So the politics of it aren't as quite as ferocious as they might seem.
Lest anybody think that China is catching up to us, there are two points to bring up. Number one would be the comparison of overall defense spending, and number two would be how much China actually spends on internal security versus the military. This is a very interesting thing you bring up in the book.
Absolutely, yes. So the overall Chinese defense budget, I mean, it's kind of hard to pin it down completely because people don't necessarily trust the headline figure that the Chinese put out, but it's roughly about a third of what the U.S. spends. Maybe sort of 150, 160 billion towards what the U.S. headline budget for the Pentagon is now, about 500 billion. So that is a big gap. And so the U.S. still has a decisive advantage in that sense. But the thing you have to remember, though, is that China at the moment, in military terms at least, is really just focused on Asia. It's really just focused on trying to shift the balance of power within Asia, where the U.S. has global responsibilities. It's heavily involved in the Middle East, and now, with everything that's going on in Ukraine at the moment, it's so heavily engaged in Europe as well. So although the U.S. has a big spending advantage, the Chinese are much more closely focused on what they're aiming at. And so that means that it's not necessarily an apples-to-apples comparison.
And how much does China spend on internal security versus military?
Well, that's another one that's almost impossible to pin down. But there have been some estimates suggest that actually they spend a little bit more on internal security. And I think the broader point of that is that, for all the sort of the bluster and confidence that we see in China, and that is part of, how the China sees itself, there is this sort of deep sense of insecurity as well. This is a regime that is both, confident and ambitious, but also looking over its shoulder constantly. They're very worried about internal dissent, very worried about protest, very worried about this new middle class becoming and sort of wanting to sort of shake up the political system. And so, they feel they have to spend a lot of money on trying to damp that down as well. So it's an uneasy mix of sort of confidence and insecurity behind the sort of Chinese regime.
Interesting. And as you point out, the regime, the power is somewhat diffuse, and so it's not like one strong person rises to the top.
Very much so.
The other thing about China's view of the world, though, is isn't the 20th century viewed as the century of humiliation for China?
That's very much how they think about the period from the 1840s, which was really the start of when
Hong Kong was taken,
the French, and Hong Kong and Shanghai and all these other ports became essentially colonies, and And up until the 1949, when Mao Zedong came to power, and they describe that period as the century of humiliation. And really, since the Tiananmen massacre, when the Communist Party suffered this huge crisis of legitimacy, they've fallen back very much on this kind of nationalist narrative that, you know, the Communist Party is the people that, you know, defeated these foreign powers, that allowed China to stand up, allowed China to be proud, playing on the sense of suffering and humiliation. And so there is underlying in the Chinese nationalism at the moment, there is this kind of emotional sense that we want a bit of payback. This is our time. We want to, you know, we want to, not quite revenge, but certainly to get back at some of these countries that infringe on us so much during that century.
Jeff Dyer is our guest. His book, The Contest of the Century, The New Era of Competition with China and How America Can Win. We'll come back with some phone calls and emails from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Jeff Dyer of the Financial Times. He's formerly the paper's Beijing bureau chief. He's written a book about China and the United States called The Contest of the Century, The New Era of Competition with China and How America Can Win. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the subject matter. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Email address jx@jeffnet.org. We have an email here from Scott in Ashland. He says, I have two questions. Number one, Mr. Dyer spoke earlier of the importance of ideology in the Chinese Communist Party's portrayal of itself to the world. How does the party currently explain itself, given the transformation of China's economy into a more market-oriented and even capitalist one? Is it still a party of the left in some fashion? Number two, the title of the book implies that there's a contest that America must win, implying a zero-sum game. Aren't there opportunities for benefit to all sides from China's development? Or must we reconcile ourselves to viewing the situation as a competition that requires a winner and a loser? Again, this from Scott in Ashland. Jeff, it's yours.
Two very interesting questions. The first one on ideology. Definitely after they started introducing economic reforms in the 70s, and especially after the Tiananmen Square massacre in 1989 in China, the Communist Party has faced this legitimacy crisis. It has realized that it can no longer fall back on the sort of old leftist slogans that it used to use. And the two main things that they've used to try and buttress legitimacy, the first one is just the record for economic achievements and just the fact that so many hundreds of millions of people have been pulled out of poverty, and so the living standards have grown so much in the last 30 years. That's a very powerful record that the Communist Party can point to say that why we still retain the right to be in power. But the other thing that they've used, as I was mentioning earlier, is this kind of hair-shirt nationalism narrative, the idea that, you know, we, the Communist Party, are the people who defended China's honor against these imperial powers. We are the people who stood up. We are the people who resurrected China. And using that as a way to try and gain some kind of emotional unity. And it's a kind of nationalism that's very anti-Japanese, but also deeply skeptical about the U.S. as well. And it has this emotional quality underlying it, this sort of sense of payback that, you know, now is our time to kind of push back against these people. The second question, I think you're absolutely right. It's not a zero-sum game. It's not. The Cold War was won when the Soviet economy collapsed. And that's absolutely not what the situation is here. The goal for the U.S., if you like, is not to sort of undermine the Chinese economy, to collapse the economy. The goal for the U.S. is to just try and remain, you know, the kind of key relevant power in the world, the power that gets to sort of influence and shape events as much as possible to its own ends, despite this growing challenge from a country that's going to have an economy that will probably at some stage in the next decade or two be the same size as the U.S., if not bigger. And good, remember, this is something the U.S. has never really had to deal with. And in the Cold War, the Soviet economy was maybe half the size of the U.S. You know, the Chinese economy is probably going to be the same size, if not bigger. And some people would say in 30 years it could be even twice as big. So it's really a sort of, from that point of view, from the kind of, feel like, the scale of China and the interest it's going to have around the world and the resources it's going to have available, it is a kind of challenge to the U.S. place in the world that the U.S. has never really seen before, even though it's not the same kind of intense, due to the death ideological struggle that the Cold War was. It's a much more subtle and complicated kind of competition.
Scott, thanks for the email questions. Here is a phone call from Jim in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jeff Dyer, the author of The Contest of the Century.
Yes, good morning. When they talk about China, the word implosion comes to mind. They talk about every year there are hundreds and hundreds of new millionaires, but nobody's talking about the over 800 million of have-nots. And any great empires from Rome to Great Britain to whatever, that's what caused the less expansive, you know, the downfall. I look for China to almost have an implosion, some for their version of an Arab Spring or something.
All right. So because of the difference in classes there.
Tremendous difference.
All right. Good point. Thanks for that, Jim. Appreciate it. Jeff, your thoughts?
So part of that I agree with, part of that not quite agree with so much. Definitely one of the big vulnerabilities is the growing inequality within China. So even though the country as a whole has got much richer and most people have seen their living standards increase dramatically, there's a lot of people at the top that have got much, much richer and have done much better than people lower down the scale. And that's a constant sore. It's becoming a real issue in Chinese politics, especially as you see all these stories about corrupt officials who've made good on land deals and property deals. And this is a real kind of possible cancer for the Communist Party. So inequality is a big issue. But actually, I think the sort of possible threat in the long term to the Chinese Communist Party is not actually from the poor. It's actually from the middle classes. The middle classes who are going to want to be more involved in the way the country is run, are going to want to have a say, who are pushing for less censorship of the media, are pushing for less Communist Party control of the legal system, are pushing for less Communist Party control of civil society. It's the middle class are the ones who are the real problem for the Communist Party. They're going to have to find some way to accommodate if they want to remain in power without kind of creating huge political tensions that will create some sort of confrontation.
Well, and that was the other part of the question I wanted to ask was, given that growth is never always in one direction, given what China has gotten into with the way its economy has been growing for essentially two decades straight now, at some point it's going to slow down, we have to assume. And at that point, does the legitimacy of the regime get called into question, and will it be by the middle class, as you're suggesting?
So very much so. I mean, that's, you know, if the Chinese economy really kind of sputters to a halt for a number of years, I mean, they can have one or two bad years, but for a number of years, then really all bets are off in terms of the, you know, party's ability to retain itself in power. But the key thing, I think the headline growth rates, it's a little bit deceptive, and I think the key issue is the sort of amount of jobs that are created. And the Chinese economy in the last decade was very investment-intensive. It was all about building roads and airports and infrastructure. And that created this huge kind of growth in headline GDP, but actually didn't create that many jobs. It wasn't as efficient creating jobs as it could have been. If the economy moves to a more services kind of economy, you can actually create many more jobs at a much lower rate of growth. But that's a real problem for the party, because that means changing the sort of balance of power within the economy so that big state-owned companies become less important and small private businesses become much more important. That means basically taking power away from powerful vested interests within the Chinese Communist Party. So that's one of the real tricks they're going to have to pull off in the next decade, is to slowly reduce the kind of influence, the very dominant influence that big state-owned companies have enjoyed, and open more space for small private entrepreneurial businesses. It's not at all clear that they'll be able to manage that trick, because those companies are very powerful vested interests within the system.
Given the diffusion of power then within China, both economically and politically, it raises the question, when we talk about the growth of the Chinese military, how firm is the civilian control of the military? Is there any sign of adventurous fellows within the military itself?
So this is almost the most difficult issue for kind of China watchers to get a hand on, because it's a real black box. I mean, we really have very little sense of the actual relationship between the Communist Party and the military. The broad conclusion that most people have is that fundamentally the party still controls the military. There's not a sort of core challenge to the authority of the party. But what you do see around the edges is just a sort of more restive military, a more kind of nationalist military. It's a proud military that now has these capabilities that they want to use. And so they're just pushing slowly, you know, behind the scenes, just kind of pushing and nudging the leaders rather than confronting the leaders. I think that's more the dynamic that we're seeing in the moment, is a slow internal pressure rather than a kind of big split, if you like, between the party and the military.
The you mentioned arriving in Beijing to take your job as the Financial Times bureau chief. Was that in 2009, I guess it was? And there was a Robert Kaplan piece in The Atlantic that was called How We Would Fight China, which you said at the time when you first looked at it, it kind of angered you. Why, and what actually did you read in the article?
So at the time, I was actually back in about 2005, and I just before I was in Beijing, I was based in Shanghai for 3 years, and that's about that time that the article came out. And this was, 2005, it was the worst years of the Iraq War, and it just seemed to me that this was a sort of crazy neoconservative idea that, even if things were going so badly in Iraq, that already people were sort of picking the next enemy. But actually, when you read the articles by Michael Robert Kaplan and started to think about these issues more fully, I started to realize that actually it is an important issue. It's not as kind of warmongering, bloodthirsty as it is, in the sense that stability in Asia in the last 40 years has ultimately depended on the fact that the U.S. retains very powerful deterrent capacity against anyone wanting to sort of shake up the Asian order, anyone wanting to try and redraw borders or to try and impose themselves and dominate Asia. But that has not happened because the U.S. has been able to deter anyone from actually trying to do that. And for Asia to remain this kind of prosperous, humming hub of the global economy, it's going to be very important for the U.S. to retain that deterrent capability. So as long as it's not done in an overly aggressive, confrontational way, as long as the U.S. adapts to the rising Chinese military in a more defensive, more conciliatory kind of way, that's very important. The U.S. still does actually maintain that kind of deterrent capability, that kind of military presence that can damp down these types of tensions.
Given the growth in the Navy itself and the growth in the range of the Navy's ability to move around the waters around China, then, as you point out in the book, there actually have been some encounters between ships of the two countries. And what's been the general nature of those?
So there have been a couple of skirmishes. There was one interesting one in 2009. There was actually one just before Christmas where an American cruiser, I think, was in the South China Sea and was essentially turned back by a couple of Chinese warships that were patrolling around the new Chinese aircraft carrier. And in a sense, it's a sort of, these are not military confrontations, but they're just a kind of pushing and shoving almost. It's the Chinese trying to impress upon the U.S. that they're no longer welcome to have their warships just patrolling free, near to the Chinese coast. So they think the U.S. should be pushed further and further back out into the Pacific, and the Chinese should have more control over these seas. But as I say, these are not military operations, they're not confrontations, they're not battles in any sense. They're just a sort of, the kind of pushing and shoving, if you like a bar fight rather than a battle.
Is that sort of like when the Soviet fighter jets used to wander into American airspace near Maine, and they'd scramble crews to go up and just sort of wave them off?
There's a little bit of that, and there's actually a lot of that going on between Chinese and the Japanese at the moment over the disputed islands in the East China Sea, which the Japanese call the Senkakus and the Chinese call the Diaoyu Islands. And really every week there are activities like that where Chinese ships get close to the islands and Japanese ships try and shoo them away. Chinese fighter jets patrol around the islands and Japanese fighter jets buzz them away. And that's one of the real potential flashpoints at the moment. Not that China would try and invade these islands, but that you get some kind of accident, a couple of planes clashing into each other, and that because of the nationalist tensions on both sides, because the nationalism is very strong in Japan as well at the moment, that an incident like that would quickly get out of control. That's one of the real sort of potential flashpoints in East Asia at the moment.
Well, and Jeff Dyer, you do give a fair amount of the book over to How America Can Win, which is part of your subtitle there. But you start with points about how to keep the United States from sliding, and it seems like number one is national debt. How do you explain that part?
Well, more broadly, it's just that it's almost a sort of truism that if the U.S. can't revive its economy in a more sustainable way, and not just the kind of recovery that we've seen since the crisis where the stock market's doubled, but a much broader recovery where middle-class salaries and manufacturing rebound, then it's going to be very hard for the U.S. to really sustain in the long term this central position in the world. If it has an anemic economy for the next decade or two, then that's obviously going to undermine American foreign policy. So in as much as high debt levels are one part of the fact that it's restraining the U.S. economy, and that's a controversial topic amongst economists, that's one part of the broader project to regenerate U.S. economic power and therefore broader U.S. foreign policy power.
And you suggest, too, leading from behind, how possible, given that there are periodic bursts, they're always there, hawks in Washington who want to be more aggressive.
So, as I mentioned before, it's very important that the U.S. military still has this sort of deterrence of power to make sure that China is not tempted into a sort of grab for glory in Asia. But underlying that, one of the most important things that the U.S. should encourage is actually cooperation between different Asian countries. I'm already seeing, you know, lots of that. So you're seeing the Japanese and the Indians collaborating a lot. The Vietnamese are looking out to all sorts of other countries in the region. You know, the Australians are working with the South Koreans, they're working with the Japanese, they're working with the Indians. So there's a whole sort of network of military ties amongst other countries in Asia that are kind of second layer of restraint and deterrence against China. And the U.S. in the past might have been slightly worried by that. It might have thought that these kinds of, you know, alliances and cooperations were a way of cutting the U.S. out. But actually, they work very much in America's interests, and the U.S. should encourage these things to happen. It's a sort of very much dovetails with everything that the U.S. is trying to do with its military in Asia.
It almost sounds like a neighborhood watch program in a sense.
Yes, that's a very good analogy, actually. I mean, these are not military alliances, but they're just a sort of, they're cooperation and you know, collaboration between these different countries. They're just another kind of warning to China that if you try and push us too hard, if you do make some sort of dash for glory, there will be consequences for you.
Well, there's a lot to learn from the book. It is called The Contest of the Century, The New Era of Competition with China and How America Can Win. Jeff Dyer works for the Financial Times and wrote the book and has joined us on The Exchange today. Jeff, thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on.
All right. That'll do it for today's Exchange. You can find out more about the program and subjects and suggest a guest at jeffexchange.org. You can also find program topics and recordings on our Facebook page. Same links available on Twitter. If you're listening in the morning, the takeaway is coming up next. Our evening rebroadcast is followed by news from the BBC. Tomorrow, Wednesday, on The Exchange at 8 o'clock, we'll talk to the supporters of the Jackson County Library's measure. Then we'll have our Vents Day segment at 8:30. At 9 o'clock, we'll talk to the author of a book about women in today's world. It is called Born to Receive. That's all tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer is Charlotte Duren. Our student assistant is Reed Newland. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Please join us again tomorrow at 8 for another edition of the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. And have a great day.